listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM, GM, etc.,
Mugil.
This is episode 182, as I'm just realizing presently, recorded on the 21st of February, 2024. It's comparing.
Really closing in on 200 episodes, man.
Yeah, we're getting there. That'll be something to do a thing about. I don't know. Quote me on that. Something to do a thing about. Mugil, anything new,
Tom,
in the world of role playing games for you?
Well, it is still RPG zine month, zine RPG month, I should say, on Kickstarter, on BackerKit, on ZineQuest. And so because the shenanigans have been continuing, I will once again cover a bunch of these zine RPGs that are being crowdfunded. And I mean, what's new for what's new in terms of RPGs for me? I've just been really enjoying browsing all of these new zine RPGs that are coming out and going like, oh, that's a really cool idea. Oh, that's an interesting idea. And, trying to sort of make my mind up, like if I was going to buy, you know, three of them, which three would it be? Tough choice.
Huh? Yeah, I am in a new situation as of last night, as of yesterday, I believe, where a friend has invited me to play in their upcoming game of Cyberpunk Red.
Cyberpunk Red.
This is the tabletop RPG, the current Cyberpunk tabletop RPG, but in the same universe as Cyberpunk 2077, Johnny Silverhands and all that. Cyberpunk Red, the world has gotten way fucked up. Because a dangus nuke went off in Night City. And it cast a red pall over the night sky.
Whoa. Damn.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure it had something to do with Johnny Silverhand.
Now, Tom, I have played the new game, Cyberpunk 2077, but that is actually the only, like, Cyberpunk TM thing that I have engaged with. Now, can you correct me if I've got my history wrong, though? Didn't the Cyberpunk franchise start as a tabletop RPG?
It did, and that was, yeah, I believe, Cyberpunk 2020?
Whoa. Damn, we're in the future. And then, there was also a previous video game at some point, wasn't there? I might be starting to mix it up with Shadowrun.
Man, there's a lot of... Oh, yeah, you might be thinking of Shadowrun at that point. I don't know if there was ever another Cyberpunk video game.
Okay. It did start as a TTRPG, became an open world video game.
So,
and now they've redone the RPG to incorporate the stuff from the video game.
I think so I've got a series history here on the Cyberpunk fandom wiki. We got released in 1988, the first Cyberpunk game, Cyberpunk 2013, introduced players to the world of the dark future. Three supplementary books were released, fleshing out the world and the character roles. In 1990, a second edition was released titled Cyberpunk 2020. Timeline was moved forward 7 years to the year 2020. As a result, much of the information from 2013 was greatly expanded upon. The setting of Night City became real. Many of the corporations were given full backstories. In 1993, the timeline was again pushed forward by another 7 years with Cyber Generation, which focused on supernatural abilities in a more dangerous world. Cyber Generation series then turned into a spin-off in an alternate reality. So that happened. In 1997, the Firestorm books were published. These two, originally three adventure books, were meant to introduce the concept of the fourth corporate war to the player, move the story forward into the late 2020s to 30s. The campaign pitched the player up against Arasaka, but with the help of the named characters throughout the series, such as Morgan Blackhand and Johnny Silverhand. A third Firestorm book was planned, but eventually became part of the Cyberpunk version 3 rulebook. So in 2005, Cyberpunk version 3 was published. Timeline pushed into the 2030s was a direct follow-up to the events in the Firestorm series. Had to deal with the fallout of the Fourth Corporate War and the Arasaka nuke in Night City, the data corruption on the net. Reviews were negative based on the setting change, as well as some of the
presentation. Wait, this is the one you're playing?
Elements in the book. No, no, no. We're just getting to that.
Oh, okay.
In 2000...
I was like, wait, you're playing the one that was banned?
or no. Well, sorry, it's very confusing here. In 2013... Polish video game developer CD Projekt Red announced that they had acquired the license to develop video games based on the Cyberpunk series with creator Mike Pondsmith working closely with the Polish studio. Cyberpunk 2077 would move the timeline much further into the year 2077. The game had a full reveal in 2018, players assuming the role of V, a lowly cyberpunk in Night City. You remember that?
Yep. Mike
Pondsmith later announced Cyberpunk Red, a new edition of the pen and paper RPG set sometime before 2077. As a result of the Red edition and 2077, the timeline was significantly changed. Creator Mike Pondsmith has said the official timeline is up in the air regards to later editions. As such, elements of the Firestorm books and version 3 books have been retired, though which elements are currently unknown. With the release of Cyberpunk Red Jumpstart Kit, it is revealed that the Fourth Corporate War, the crash of the net, and the Arasaka mini-nuke events all canonically occur. The world book places the Fourth Corporate War as starting in 2021 but becoming official in 2022. The crash of the net is caused by the data crash virus triggered by a dead man switch activated with the death of Rache Bartmoss. Do you know how to pronounce that name?
R-A-C-H-E?
Yeah.
My instinct is rash, similar to, like, cash, right?
Okay. Anyways, that happened in 2022. The Arasaka mini-nuke event is referred to as the Night City Holocaust and is shown to take place in 2023. And, like, so, basically, it's not clear whether 2077 is like part of the same timeline or if it's like maybe a spinoff or something. Like, I guess they're kind of confused about it, but it would take place like, what's the math on that? If Cyberpunk Red takes place, like, way before 2077, basically. Like, many years before.
Mm-hmm. And you've been invited to play it.
Yes.
But you haven't started playing it yet.
No. I've created my character. I'm a fixer.
Did you play the video game? Have you played any other Cyberpunk properties? Oh, wow.
Man. Yeah, they've rebuilt quite a bit. They must have rebuilt quite a bit by the time of 2077 because, like, in Cyberpunk Red, there's been, like, orbital bombardments and fucking nukes going off in Night City and all this stuff. Red sky from Fallout. It's crazy.
Yeah, ain't none of that in the video game.
Yeah, but I guess like it's way after the recovery from that, theoretically. yeah, like, I don't know. There's a whole timeline in Cyberpunk Red Book that I was reading. I wonder how far up does it go? Yeah. Oh, so Cyberpunk Red is set in 2045. So 77 is 77 minus 45.
Oh, I'm just going to let I'm going to wait.
32.
There you go.
I just Googled it.
Oh, come on.
But I don't know, 32 years, and it's like, even then, the big explosion happened in 2023, so there's been like...
We all remember that.
Man, hey, that's right. Big old nuke went off in Night City. I hear that Keanu Reeves was involved.
Whoa.
Anyways, I'm just getting all off topic just to say that, like, I'm getting into Cyberpunk Red. I've been looking into that world. And
it's cool. I can't wait to hear how the system plays, how it stacks up to all these other systems you've been playing.
Yeah, we'll see.
Hey, speaking of RPG systems I know nothing about, there is actually one other piece of news. It'll probably be, I don't know, it might still be available by the time this episode gets published, but I know I sent you a link. The Humble Bundle, the Humble Book Bundle right now, yeah, and paranoia. For the next 16 days, is a giant bundle of... It's 32 source books and modules and expansions for Paranoia, which is a game that I'm aware of, but this is another one, much like Cyberpunk. It's very extensive, and I have not once ever played it. Do you know much about Paranoia? Have you ever played it?
I've played Paranoia once. I played it with, like, the Carleton University, like, role-playing society or whatever, like... someone ran a game of Paranoia, and it was like two guys sort of like co-GMing it, and it was cool because they were like, they really played it up in a way that worked really well, where, like, for example, like, we had to kind of fill out forms and almost like interview for our character classes or like our roles in the party. And so, like, they'd have us go into the room like one at a time and talk to them, and they'd like look over our forms, and for mine they were like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's very interesting, while like looking at my form in front of me. And yeah, it's a really kind of just like insane slapstick game. Yeah, I don't know. It's not really my style. I don't know if I'm hugely into like comedic games.
So is it? It's Although intentionally
I like,
comedic?
I like Fiasco. Yes, it is like very I don't know, satirical? Is that the word? But, like, yeah, you end up with, like, crazy situations where, like, I don't know. My friend Florence always tells me this story about a game where the task was to level a crooked table, and one player just solves the problem by cutting off their left thumb and putting it under the table leg. And they were asked, why did they do that? And he said, because my right thumb would be inappropriate. yeah, you serve...
I went to... back in the day, I went to Fandom 2, and I asked the guy there if they had any of the Paranoia source books, and he said, they're right behind you.
Ah! It's you serve a capricious, crazy computer overlord. Your lives are like miserable and short and don't make sense. I remember in the game that I played, at one point we were like ascending up a skyscraper or something, and like on the last level there were just like fucking modified war bears. And then at the end of the game, I had like secretly been a pyrokineticist, like had pyrokinetic abilities the whole time, but I just spent the whole game like storing up all my sort of like mutation points, until at the very end I released all of them in one insane conflagration, in which I sort of turned myself into a momentary god of fire, but then died a legend, that was heavily censored by the weird computer autocracy.
Sounds like it could be fun. And if that's your thing, go on over to the Humble Bundle website and get this 32 book bundle for Paranoia.
There's a weird thing about Paranoria where they tried to do a computer game of it, a game, and like apparently it was like on like Steam. It was one of those things where like it was on Steam, but then it became like an Epic Store exclusive, but then they didn't release it on Epic Store, but like some people were able to get it on Steam or some nonsense like that. It's like very bizarre, but like it was completely pulled, and like I don't know what the deal is with it at all. It's crazy nonsense to me. Although it's, I guess,
Sounds like a
kind of appropriate.
conspiracy.
Yeah, it sounds kind of appropriate to the whole game. So anyways, after all of that other stuff, my side of the podcast, we're gonna be going back to Coyote's Aegis, where we're in the Underdark, looking for a passage through to get behind enemy lines in the mantle. But there's been some strange incidents. They've been dealing with a little demon creature that makes fart noises and laughs at them. And now they're just sort of searching around. They'd solved one puzzle involving reflections, and that had opened up a new room, and that's where we left off.
With the fart demon.
That's true. Tiny fart demon, as I called him. When we left off, they had just opened the secret door concealing a hidden chamber within the cavern they're seeking passage through. A large door in the southern wall of the cavern remains shut, but it's possible the means to open it is in this hidden area. The small chamber is lined with tiny stone alcoves containing scroll cases. One alcove contains only a single scroll case, which rests on a pile of gold coins. And, Hex's robe of eyes flicked between the pile of gold and scroll and gent nervously. It says, "Now let's bear in mind that there may be some traps here." And gent says, "Good thing I am smart." And Alex asks, "Is the imp still with us?" And I say, "The demon is watching wide-eyed from the top of one of the stony ramps that leads to the end of this cavern." Connor turns to the demon and asks, "Who do you serve? Gratz, why are you here?" And the demon hesitates before saying, "Eh? I serve that drow lady. Jade? Something. Haven't seen her in ages. Probably dead." And Chantel asks if we recall the name, but Alex explains, "I think that's the undead drow lady we killed a ways back." And I say, "Correct. Jada was the undead drow you fought before the Battle of Ashcrain Outpost, and what you've learned here suggests that her faction of undead drow, including the ones you fought here in the grotto, used this cavern as a safe house of sorts. So you're what, guarding the hideout till she gets back? Not doing a very good job, are you? Do I look like a guard? She just left me with that dumb hint for her stupid secret room full of dumb scrolls. He gestures to the room. What's in the dumb scrolls? The demon shrugs. You're so smart, you read them. Jent says, so she wanted people to get a hint. So it is something she wanted someone to see. Definitely trapped. Connor eyes the demon warily and rejoins the group. Watch out for spiders, Hex mutters. I'm not so sure, the guide interjects. Remember, they have a drow guide with them. The group we fought earlier seemed like they'd been out of contact with her for some time. It's possible she left the demon for them rather than us. The guide adds, not that we shouldn't exercise due caution. I assume you have some way of dealing with potential traps. And Gent first checks the door frame for traps, and I have them roll investigation. No advantage or disadvantage. While Gent has the benefit of trioptics, they are still buzzed by the intoxicating refreshment of the magic pool. That was last episode as they explored the grotto. Gent, after rolling, is certain the doorway is not trapped. There are a lot of hidden mechanisms built in the surrounding wall, though. This makes sense based on the number of clicks that they heard when operating the three spider buttons to open the door. It would be almost impossible to build a trap into this door and still have it function properly. Gent then checks the floor. The floor is dusty and unremarkable. You don't see any kind of real work done on the floor at all. It's the least interesting part of the room, except for maybe the ceiling. Then Gent looks around the area around the scroll, Indiana Jones style, they do their best to sift through the coins without disturbing them such that they may trigger some kind of trap. To their relief, nothing goes off. They determine that the scroll case is not fastened to anything in the alcove, and so may be snatched from the alcove. While the possibility of some weight-based trigger is the thing weighing on your mind as you search, you're surprised to find an entirely different kind of mechanism. A small switch has been concealed in the back of the alcove, which you can reach in and flip. Jen says, well, fuck, I flip it. The switch is stiff, so flipping it takes some effort. Upon doing so, you find that a new alcove has opened in the wall, above the others. Inside, a tome rests alongside a fine black longbow accented with what appear to be long, sharp teeth. Gent says, shiny new bow! I think I heard a sound from the main cavern when you hit that switch. We might want to check that door through again when we feel ready to proceed, the guide says. Gent is too busy doing a I found shiny things dance to pay attention to him. Connor approaches one of the other alcoves and picks up a scroll. Anything interesting? I say the scroll cases have drow writing on them. Connor hands it to the guide and says, anything interesting here? He nods. The guide assists them in identifying all the scrolls by reading the drow elven writing on the cases. They find the following spell scrolls. Protection from fiends, protection from aberrations, animate dead, bestow curse, dispel magic, mass healing word, magic circle, and remove curse. Alex says, do we even know this guy's ask? Do we even know this guy's name? And I say, you have not asked him. He's been the guide this whole time. It's like, oh, damn. Gent says, well, I feel like a dick. He says, I'm sorry, soldier. We've been preoccupied with our mission. What do you call yourself? I say, it's the most common thing I find is I name an NPC and it never even comes up. But I always have it, just in case. Din, the drow says. He seems preoccupied by the scroll case on the pile of gold. Is it safe to check? He asks Gent. Let me grab it. We can afford for me to take a hit in case. Gent grabs the scroll, and they grab the scroll case and find they are safe. Nothing happens. So they hand it over. Din examines the case and announces that it is a scroll of legend lore. This may be useful for learning the nature and potential weaknesses of the fiend that guards the way up into the mantle, he says. And Gent has already moved on to look at the metal bow. And, Connor grunts, "Got all that from reading the tin, did you?" I tell Gent, "The bow is black and features dragon teeth as accents to its design. The string seems to be composed of web silk, a fine drow weapon, to be sure." Din shoots a smirking glance back at Connor. "I made us all levitate to the ceiling in the fight earlier, didn't I? I could cast from these scrolls in a pinch." Sorry. Gent asks, "What does the tome look like?" And Connor says, "You hadn't mentioned a fiend guarding the way yet." Din blinks at Connor. "I assumed I got the same briefing you did. I'm supposed to take you through to where the fiend is. But," he indicates the scroll, "with just the information of its nature and the fact that it's guarding the way ahead, a legend lore spell should work." I tell Gent, "The tome is, well, very drow. Web patterns, skulls. Do you flip through it?" He says, "Sure." I say, "Roll insight with advantage." The book appears to
I know much better than to flip through any random tome that you give me as GM.
I say, "The book appears to be composed of recipes accompanied by long passages of writing that follow each list of ingredients. There are figures included as well, generally detailing strange herbs and fungi, with diagrams indicating specific parts and substances gathered from them. Between this and the tome's placement next to the drow bow, you feel fairly certain the subject of this tome is poison." Gent says, "Badass." Connor asks Din, "How long would this spell take?" The drow shrugs, "About 10 minutes. "Well, you said you heard something outside. Let's check that out first, at least." Connor gathers up the other scrolls. Gent grabs the bow and tome. I have Connor roll insight, and he rolls 27. I say, "The drow frowns and seems reluctant to go, but proceeds back to the door in the main cavern as instructed." "Easy. Just want to make sure that wasn't the sound of more undead arriving," Connor says. "All right," Din says. "But this might be our last chance to rest and prepare before we head through that door. Might also be the right time to try that legend lore scroll." Connor takes a deep breath. "Well, I suppose you are the guide. Shall we oblige him?" Connor looks to the group. Gent says, "Sure." Hex looks up from picking his claws and nods. Asking about the fiend who guards the Underdark passage into the mantle, the group receives the following message. "Emperor of lies, whose words bring kings to their knees. Beauty so great, the Dark Prince cursed him to weep blood in the looking glass. Lord of three, who rules through a crown of command." And this is all actually from the module. I can't take credit for this. This is from the second phase of the epic that it took place in. If you get the Scroll of Legend lore and then cast it in regards to the demon that you have to fight, you can learn this interesting little thing about them.
That's probably fine. No big deal, right?
Connor looks over at the demon servant of Jada. "Ever heard of him?" The demon shrugs. "Sounds like one of them pretty boy incuboys." The demon spits. "We ready?" Din looks around at the group. "Sure we wanted to leave all that gold behind?" The drow grins. "Oh, right, of course. Let me grab that." Hex scoops it up. I say, "Divvying up the gold, you each receive 1,000 gold pieces. New gen DGP total is 24,404. Hex says, "Wow, quite the pile, actually." I say, "And if there was a weight trap, Gent must have disarmed it, possibly when they flipped that switch." Gent says, "My impulse control never leads me astray." I say, "Does anyone volunteer to open the door, or is that Din's job?" Gent goes to check for traps, have them do their investigate. "The door is not trapped. It is loose now, though, where it hadn't been before, so you could push it open. It's part of the same mechanism you determined in the hidden chamber." Gent says, "Okay, I will give the all clear to the others and step away." Connor approaches and gives it a hefty shove. Opening the door, they are surprised to see another drow on the other side, standing on a short stairway and looking up back at your group. There's a look of confusion and surprise on his face. "I'll be damned. I thought I'd never meet up with you." His eyes drift to their guide, who is ascending the stairs toward him. Both drow are similarly dressed, so they both appear to be members of the drow resistance. Din reaches out toward the drow on the stair. Connor casts hold person on both drow. How did you... The unfamiliar drow standing on the stairs begins to ask the guide. I ask what the DC is. Din freezes, but the other drow does not. He looks back up at the rest of the group. Then he looks down at Din, takes a startled step back. Who is he? He asks the group, clearly upset. Who are you? Grab him, Hex! Connor says. We were told to meet a drow guide, not two. Something isn't right here. Hex moves hesitantly toward the new drow. The drow throws his hands up as he sees Hex approach him. I'm the guide! Din says, oh wait, reflection was the key last time. Wait, never mind. There would be another handsome Kenku. I don't know what she meant for that. I say, my name's Tex. I'm the leader of the scouts for the Drow Resistance. I came to meet with your team, but the damn passage was sealed up. Jen immediately grabs the scrolls from Din's frozen body. Hex shakes his head. So, an imposter. But which one to trust? Hex looks down at Din on the ground. Din only has one scroll on him, but Jen finds it with ease because they caught him grabbing it when he entered the room with the map of the cavern. I believe Jen is frozen halfway up the stairs, almost in mid-sprint, reaching out toward the new guy, Tex. Jen says, can I see what else Jen has on his body? Perchance a clue? Examining Din, Jen can see that he was in the process of drawing his dart gun with the hand that wasn't reaching for Tex. Hex turns back to Tex. You're with the Drow Resistance, and you're here to meet with us? Who are we again? Could you remind me? The scroll Din was carrying, of course, is written in Drow. And I say, oh, and you find a steel mirror on Din's person. Roll insight, Jen. Jen gets a nat 20. Tex shakes his head and points to Din. Tex says, three MPOC agents from the Draelic liberation effort. Then he shakes his head and points to Din. But if we had an infiltrator, they'd know what I know. Still, he points more specifically to the dart gun Din was drawing. I'm talking this out while he was about to draw on me. Gent, it strikes you as remarkably convenient that the door required a reflection to solve, and the legend lore said the fiend is cursed to weep blood in the looking glass, yet not once did Din bring up that he was carrying a portable mirror. Jen shows Connor the mirror and whispers that to him.
This is all very paranoid.
Yeah, it's who to trust? Which drow is the real drow? With Connor's sight, he tries scrutinizing them, but they both appear as they are. Hex tries to roll insight, and I say, you recall seeing Din doing something when you followed him into the cave with the big white spider. You're not sure if it's relevant, though, because he only got a 10 on insight. And Gent removes the dart gun from Din's hand. Tex visibly eases somewhat. Hex flips over Din's hand to inspect his palms. They're empty, at least since the dart gun was removed. Oh, and they are gloved. Jen says, is the mirror anything unique? I say, nope, just a small steel mirror. Jen says, okay. Tex, it would be helpful if you emptied your pockets. Hex ties up Din. Look, this guy's about to come too, and we can ask him some questions then. Like why he wanted to shoot first and ask questions later. I have everyone roll perception. Jen doesn't get the benefit of their trioptics because they're still all buzzed from the drinking from the magic water. But Hex gets a 20. Hex sees the mischievous little demon scurrying up the stairs in his peripheral vision while the scene with the two drow plays out. Connor approaches Tex. What do you know of a fiend that guards the way? This one was very interested in learning about some kind of Lord of Lies. And Tex says, that's our target, right? The fiend that guards the mantle from this passage? I was told to bring you guys through, help you take him down. They said you needed to try and interrogate the target first. Then I could lead the way to the old stables. Jen says, please let us see what items you're carrying. I can help you unload if you need it. Tex lays down a shield, a dart gun like the one Din had, several small boxes of darts, and a large heavy drow blade. He then removes a pouch of gold from his belt and places that down, followed by two healing potions concealed under his armor. Then Alex says, "Oh crap," Connor slaps his head, and pulls out the scroll cases he recently nabbed. "Okay, let's see." Connor pulls out the one Din had told him was magic circle. He casts the scroll on its inverse function and specifies all types of outsiders, such that all of us are inside the magic circle when it appears. This process takes about a minute. Oh, and I'll leave the little demon outside the circle. I say, as you're casting, you realize that Din is no longer paralyzed when he sneers, "Should have known better than to mix these simple folk up in drow business. The demon's long gone." Sorry, that's not him saying that. He says, "Should have known better than to mix these simple folk up in drow business." But then I clarify for Alex, the demon's long gone. "If you didn't grab him when he was headed up the stairs, he bolted." Hex snaps at him. "Anything to say for yourself?" At Din. He shrugs. "You've been very helpful up till now. Maybe take a couple steps back?" Tex points at Jent. "What about the scroll you found on him?" "The one he was carrying." Jent says, "What about it?" He says, "Well, what does it say?" Jent is super hesitant to read anything and gives it to Tex. Or give it to Tex. So I have Jent roll investigate. And Jent says, "It all feels like a trap." And they roll unnatural 20. I say, "You realize there's an indent in the floor at the center of the foot of the stairs that you're all precariously close to stepping on. You notice it because when Din tells Hex to take a couple steps back, he's staring at that point in the floor." Jent says, "Everyone watch your feet. This place is boobied. Just tits everywhere." That's Chantel out of character. Hex looks down at the indent and back up to Din. "What drow business is this?" Din responds by scowling at Jent, struggling with his restraints. I have everyone roll initiative. I say, "Connor, Din is struggling with his restraints. Roll insight." He's struggling enough that you can clearly see what he intends to do. He's going to try and kick Hex back from his restrained state, which would be just enough to push him onto the trap tile. Connor continues casting his spell. I tell Jent that they can also see what Din is angling to do. And Jent says, "Yeah, I'm going to backhand them with zero strength." I say, "Wait, no, I'm going to sit on Din in an attempt to render them unable to shift around." I say, "Is the idea to prevent him from attacking? He's already restrained." And they say, "But he's shuffling." I say, "Yeah, you can still attack while restrained." And the Jent says, "Okay, then forget it. I will hold an attack action for if he wriggles free." I say, "Okay." Wide-eyed, Tex tackles the restrained drow, pushing him back through the door out of the stairway area. He looks back at your group. "Move! What the hell are you doing? Get up the stairs!" Hex mutters, that sounds like what a guide would say to me. And Jent says, "Sure," and follows. Din kicks Jent in the sins. I have Hex roll athletics or acrobatics. He rolls 25 acrobatics. Miraculously, Hex manages to clue in and step up the stairs just as Din is about to push him with the single attack five foot push it would require to move him onto the trap tile. On an action that would have serious consequences for the entire party. An action committed by a restrained individual with three turns before his act. Just outlining like how crazy it is that he even got the chance to do that. They all just like didn't stop him with it, like didn't do anything with their turns, and so he got the attack in, and miraculously Hex saves. Tex shuts the door with some effort and sprints up the stairs to rejoin you. "Okay, my turn. Are you sure you guys are who you say you are? Can you even read those scrolls? Can I pick up my fucking weapons?" The drow is incensed. Hex shrugs. "It's dangerous down here. Had to play it safe. Have I earned the right to look at the traitor's scroll by saving your slow asses?" He growls. Hex turns to Jent. "Might as well. I heard Din talking to himself earlier. Didn't seem right to me." Jent says, "Fine," and hands over the scrolls. "Also, I think he just tried to kick me." Tex looks at the scroll. Everyone rolls insight. Tex, in taking the time to read the scroll, realizes he has lost his composure and takes the moment to cool his temper. He's not good at concealing it, though. You notice the rage seems to well up in him again upon reading the scroll, but he shakes his head and hands it back to you. All right, sorry, he grunts. So, was anything juicy in there? Chantel says, do you like me? Check yes or no. Tex looks back at Hex, his face a portrait of frustration. He sighs. It says that there is a panel at the center of the foot of the stairs. If stepped on, the stairway will collapse. Jen says, well, that is specific. I say, whoever it was meant for, it advises that the way could be easily collapsed behind them should they need to make a quick escape. Tex looks at the ceiling above the stairs. Perhaps we should proceed before Ding gets another opportunity. Hex agrees. Whatever this is, we need to press on. I'm not sure Din had our best intentions in mind. A look crosses Tex's face like he suddenly had an idea. Actually, one moment. May I have his dart gun? Jen hands it over. Tex nods obligingly, then checks the dart currently loaded in the gun and smiles as he descends the stairs, keeping well to one side. He pushes the stone door open to reveal Din struggling with his restraints. I believe this was for me. Dex speaks down to the restrained drow, loading the dart back into the gun and closing the door behind him. Drow business, I suppose. Too simple to understand it myself, Hex laughs. Jen says, Hex, we should kill the other two. Jen says, Hex, we should kill the other one too. Hex says, there was a map a few rooms back. The new one says we're going to the stables. It might work. Let's keep him for now, just in case. Keep an eye on him, though. And, Hex and Connor roll perception with advantage. Jen rolls perception regularly. And no one sees it fast enough. Hex and Connor only realize in time to watch it with horror as the tiny demon from earlier comes flying down the stairs like a bag of trash thrown out a window. He lands on the trap panel. Everyone must make a dexterity saving throw. Alex says, son of a. I say, the wild card, little fart demon. You thought it was drow trickery, but it was me, tiny fart demon.
Of course.
Alex says, can Connor have at least finished his magic circle? I say, yeah, I'll allow it. He says, cool. Outsiders can't leave the circle. So the fart demon slides about 10 feet and hits an invisible wall. So much for your crazy slide, Alex says. I say, oh, you
I'm
get
a little
the-
disappointed. I'm a little disappointed that during all of this mockery where he's like, aha, I'm the tiny fart demon, you didn't have him go...
Yeah, he'd already
done
that a whole bunch.
Opportunity to blow a raspberry.
He'd already done it a whole bunch of times last episode. But I guess I sort of explained here is when he says so much for your crazy slide, I say, oh, you get the sense he was literally hurled down the stairs. He wasn't sliding. And Alex is like, oh. I say, he didn't willingly enter the circle, that's for sure. And Alex says, it's reversed, so he can enter, just not exit. I say, I will say, if you want, I'd let you hold on to the scroll. Right, I see. And Alex says, plus maybe stops bad dudes from following us. But now we gotta get up the crazy slide. Are we all just dogpiled against the door Tex just closed? And I say, so Hex and Jen actually managed to sprint up the stairs in time to not get caught in the collapse. The demon is utterly crushed. Jen says, no. R.I.P. and makes a frowny face. And Alex says he's in a Hex says he's in a weirder place now. Connor takes 96 blunt damage and is restrained in the debris from the collapsed stairway. Alex says, yikes. I say, yeah, there have been some truly wild rolls tonight. The drow was so close to kicking you onto the panel that even though he was restrained, I couldn't believe it. It was like a 25 versus a 24. Connor can make athletics or acrobatics checks to try and free himself. Meanwhile, the door opens and Tex immediately starts trying to clear the rubble from his side. I leave you for 3 seconds, Tex calls out through the mass of debris. Everyone rolls insight. Connor manages to free himself with Tex's help, receiving a hand from the drow as he's pulled from the debris. Together, they work to clear the rubble from one side, while Hex and Gent can attempt to clear it from the other. Despite Tex's remark, he seems to be in a much better mood. Executing the traitor seems to have put some spring back in his step. I say, do you all work together to clear the way? And they all do. Jen has no strength, though, so Chantel says they'll just point out loose rocks. I say, it takes about 20 minutes to clear the way with Jen's indirect assistance. Once you have finally regrouped at the top of the stairs, Tex holds out a sleek bundle consisting of the chain from Din's body armor and Din's two healing potions and gold purse wrapped up inside. Jen pulls Hex aside and whispers, they had the same loot, except for the mirror. I say the armor is remarkable elven chain made from glossy black chitin and silver. Classic drow. And, Tex says, I'd feel better if you took this. I'd no longer count that traitor among my scouts, so I don't see why his gear should be left with him. Hex whispers back to Jen, look, I don't like it either, but that first guy was weirding me out more than the second guy. Think about it, right? Right when we walked in here, he inhaled the spores off those mushrooms. Should an Underdark guide know about the mushrooms? And Connor takes the bundle of gear and smiles. Very efficient of you. Glad to see you don't waste. Chantel, or Gent says, when Tex betrays us, you have to give me half your gold. And Gent rejoins the group. Everyone gains 100 gold from Din's coin purse, and he had two healing potions. Tex could add them to his collection for the upcoming confrontation, or the group could take them, but they're just regular healing potions. And I asked, does anyone specific take the healing potions or the armor? Gent takes the potions. Hex throws the chain armor in his bag of holding. Gent's new gold total is 24,504. Tex checks his own gear. We ready? And Gent says, yep, wait. And takes up a large rock and sets it up like a marker and scratches on it. Here's life. Here lies fart. And says, okay, now I am good. Hexakila leaves a gold coin. Let's go. The stairs ascend to a stone trap door. Raising it with care, they peer into a dust-filled ruined hall shaped like a hollowed spider. Tiny spiders crawl everywhere. Their webs cling to every surface. In the center of the hall, a floating disk of blood quivers above a ring of candles. Every few seconds, bloody gouts break from its surface from above and below. A man wearing crimson robes and a black iron crown stands nearby. Long horns curl from his brow and scaled wings sprout from his shoulders. Yet you have never seen anyone so beautiful. This is again from the module. This is the description of the demon that they end up having to fight in this part of the module. Connor casts heal on himself at sixth level before going up. And behind the trap door, they see another drow agent lying unconscious on the web-strewn floor. The spiders that skitter across every surface are swarming her, threatening to eat her alive. The fiend turns to face the group. From the shadows, a vulture-like demon emerges, accompanied by another drow traitor. As the Vrock's abyssal stench washes over the group, the horned figure smiles. You took your time. Now you shall pay the price. Tex curses to himself. How many of my scouts were fucking turncoats? With a wave of his hand, five tiny demons similar to the one you just buried come gleefully scurrying out from behind the fiend. And at this point... broke. That was where we ended the session. Next time, they gotta try and interrogate this Dangus demon before they kill him.
So much suspicion, so much backstabbing. Knew we couldn't trust that fart demon.
I mean, it wasn't even the fart demon's fault. It was the Dangus fiend that threw the fart demon back down the trapdoor.
Well, R.I.P. fart.
Yeah. But he's been replaced by a whole bunch more, they're all Quasits.
Oh, yeah, Quasits. I know those guys.
Those tiny little demons.
Yeah, they're like the little hippity-hoppity kind of ghoulies demons. Little gremlin-y dudes, right? And yeah. Sometimes they got wings.
Yeah, I don't think Fart did, but
good old Quasits.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a session that stayed with me because I remember the treachery of Tiny Fart Demon.
I appreciate that, you know, you've been doing a lot of the combat-heavy sessions lately. I appreciate that this one was had more of a suspicion sort of direction to it, where it's sort of like who to trust and feelings like, you know, there's something off, something's not quite right. What's really going on?
It's totally owed to the Adventurers League Season 3 epic, Blood Above, Blood Below. They have it built in that you can have the guide is a traitor or something.
That's great.
Gets up to no good.
So we are still in that big epic, yeah?
Yeah, we're just at the end of the second part out of three.
Wow. It's huge. Using the whole meat got you like, sounds like what, a couple of months of games?
Yeah, probably something like that.
Right on. Tom, are you ready to look at more zine RPGs? Maybe I can convince you that if you had five of my dollars, yeah, maybe I can convince you to kick it towards one of these crowdfunding campaigns. What do you say?
Hit me with it.
All right. So, once again, I'm going to go in like reverse order from the one that I think will interest Tom the least to the one that I think you will be most interested in. And we're starting this one off. Project, the Kickstarter is still ongoing for it, but it has met its goal, and it's an RPG called 100% Modern Ghosts. This is by game designer B. Marsolier, who is a Canadian podcast host, GM, illustrator, voiceover artist, and fledgling game designer. And she wanted to make a game that was evocative of like spooky slumber party games, right? You're at like a sleepover or something and someone gets out in a Ouija board, or you go and you play Bloody Mary looking into the mirror. Those spooky slumber party games were the source of inspiration for 100% Modern Ghosts. And unfortunately, the Kickstarter campaign doesn't give you a lot of sense of what the actual gameplay is like. I mean, maybe that's part of the goal. You pledge and then you get to sort of find out how the game itself plays. But the basic layout of this, the basic premise is that you're all acting as researchers for the Bureau of Occult Observation, or BOO.
BOO.
Which is BOO, which is, a ghost study organization, all about researching and documenting modern ghosts. And the kinds of modern ghosts, well, here, I'll just use the game designer's exact words here. Remember when you were a kid and everything that scared you felt like a ghost? Well, they were. Welcome to 100% Modern Ghosts, a humorous horror journaling zine that brings you back to those childhood days of playing scary games at slumber parties. My goal is to assist readers in mythologizing the mundane by identifying the ghosts that hide in day-to-day life and engaging with them in modern ways. There are different kinds of ghosts that are geared towards different kinds of play. So you can play this solo, There is, and each volume of this RPG contains at least one solo play ghost. And then there are also ghosts for 2 to 5 players, or 2 to more than 5 players, plus journaling prompts for all of the different ghosts. And here are some examples of the ghosts that you will encounter if you play this game. If you're playing alone, you might encounter the bodyguard. Trouble sleeping? Plagued by common bedroom ghosts? Fear not. Our documentation of the bodyguard will help you negotiate a ghost-for-hire contract, offer up your childhood fears, find a fearsome new bedfellow, and rest easy. There's also the party ghost for 5 or more players. A theoretical summoning, the party ghost is invited into reality by hosting a party and by engaging in dramatic villain speeches and declarations of revenge. Form alliances or break them. Commit an act of murder or become the victim. Plead your innocence. Evade your guilt. Will the murder victim succeed in exposing their murderers? And then I'll read this last one in Volume 1, but they also have 3 more ghosts in Volume 2 with different descriptions. The shadow ghosts that are for solo play or for 2 or more players. Explore the aesthetics of Gothic horror with only a candle, a lighter, and shadow puppets. Wander your home and meet those who live at the intersection of darkness and light. Perform a parlor trick, invite the shadow ghosts into your candle, and learn to speak and interpret their language. Now, like I said, this doesn't really explain like what the active gameplay is like with 100% modern ghosts. However, between the video, the pitch video at the top of the Kickstarter campaign, and just like the descriptions of how these different things play within the descriptions of the ghosts I just read, it seems like part of the fun of this is actually like engaging in the mundane world around you. Like these shadow ghosts, wander your home and meet those who live at the intersection of darkness and light, perform a parlor trick, invite the shadow ghosts into your candle, explore the aesthetics of Gothic horror with a candle, a lighter, and shadow puppets. I'm imagining that the gameplay for playing the shadow ghosts I guess the in-game lore would be like researching the shadow ghosts for your journal. I think the gameplay means like you and another player, or just you alone, get up from your table with a candle and look around your house and like sort of interact with the shadows of the candle, and that will, I think, somehow factor into the gameplay itself. And it says there are going to be prompts, so presumably there's a prompt that goes with the shadow ghosts, and you have to kind of journal based on what it suggests, but it's hard to suss out without knowing the exact gameplay. All that being said, I do like the idea of a wide variety of unusual ghosts that are based off of modern ideas. Like there is another one, the Knickknack Shepherd, which is the ghost that, you know, steals your knickknacks. You're missing a sock, the Knickknack Shepherd probably got it. So what do you think of this one, Tom?
I mean, I feel like I've told you before, I'm not that into ghosts.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
but not even like, I may have even said this last time, but not even like Ghostbusters ghosts.
I do love Slimer. They should all be like Slimer. They should all just be ectoplasmic goopy goops.
It seems like the ghosts in 100% modern ghosts could potentially sort of have that style to them. Like this bodyguard ghost could be a big sort of hulking monstrous looking one.
I guess. Yeah, it's just not really my thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Sounds like this is the one, the lowest rung on what Tom might be into. But here's our next one. Maybe this will be more your speed. It's an RPG called Community Radio by Thought Crime Games. It has also already met its goal with plenty of time left on the Kickstarter campaign. And what's interesting about this one is, in a nutshell, it feels like it's Fiasco meets Welcome to Night Vale. You know the podcast, Welcome to Night Vale, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and it seems like this is an intersection of those two ideas. Because, much like Fiasco, this game is like really story focused. There is not a lot of like, you don't fill out a big character sheet. You do rolling on a lot of tables with six-sided dice, but it's not like you're rolling dice for combat or anything like that. It's all just sort of generating plot elements. And what I think is neat is that it is set in a sort of Welcome to Night Vale-esque place. This weird town that has secrets. Here's some propaganda from the Kickstarter here. Your town has deep secrets, terrifying monsters, unspeakable evils, a clandestine city council making strange decrees, and a public radio station. And so the idea is you roll on all these tables to sort of set up the community where this is all taking place. There are different characters that you can integrate, like concerned parents, exchange students, or groundskeepers. Then there's a list of what is called terrors. So terrors can be things like experimental drones, the Greek geek, or hyperpox. There are some locations, bookstores, universities. There are moods, which I find interesting, but it's all like sort of setting an atmosphere. Moods are things like vacant, lonely, partying, studious. Strange items come from a table too. Items like a giant purple key or a symbol carved desk or a de-aging mirror. And then finally, you also roll on hosts, and that's to determine what I think is sort of the most fun gimmick of this, the host. Instead of a GM, the GM is called the host, and they do the usual GM things, sort of adjudicating scenes, helping build, you know, the setting and facilitate the story. But then they also, the GM also, as a radio host, does like a broadcast talking about what the players just did. So here, let me read out exactly how it's worded here. One player will be the host. They help facilitate play, but more importantly, they run the local radio show and do public announcements and reports and comment on the strange events in town. They play off the vibes of the other members of the community who act out slice-of-life scenes, brief scenes containing elements from the town that you determine at the start of play. After acting out one of these scenes, and after the host does a broadcast, the shadowy city council, which every player except the host is on, passes secret decrees that the host must then announce at random during broadcasts. So, it says here, the game is rules light, using procedural cues and tables to frame scenes of freeform and improvisational play. Players can be expected to play any member from an ensemble of absurd characters from their community, meaning the game is easy for new players to jump into and pick up, plays well with larger groups, and yeah, so again, the bottom line is this really feels like a heavily storytelling-based game like Fiasco, where you generate loads of plot elements using tables and then just play scenes where you integrate those elements. But then there's this added thing, this added Welcome to Night Vale element, where the GM also gets to sort of summarize the things in-game as the host of a radio show. And then on top of that, the players who aren't the GM get to add in story elements that the GM doesn't know about until, you know, they have to flip over the card with the community council's decree and just read it out in their radio show and integrate it into the story. I can already imagine it, you know, this just in, this paper just came across my desk, and then they pick it up and they're like, oh no, the earworm has been said to be infecting students of the local high school. Students are urged not to listen to the latest top 40 hits on the radio or something like that. So once again, here I'm kicking it over to you. Tom, what do you think of this? What do you think of this idea?
Kind of dig this one. I like the Fiasco style system that it immediately reminded me of. All I got to say is more tables, please. More tables, more tables. If this thing is just full of more tables, that'd be awesome. I do love the options for the hosts. Like, I like that you roll your host type so that the player then has to sort of like role play that type of host, whether it's a shock jock or a townie who uses highly localized slang and jargon.
Yeah.
Or a current student who asks answers, who asks for answers to unsettling homework questions on the air.
I do like just the idea of giving the GM sort of their own character to play, who isn't like a character in the story, but is still sort of like the omnipresent voiceover that you'd hear. I think that's neat. Definitely not something I've really seen in any other games now that I think about it. And yeah, more tables, please, for sure. Because the instant, instant thing that comes to mind when thinking about these radio hosts is I keep thinking about John Carpenter, how John Carpenter seems to really love characters that are sort of like a late night, you know, radio host, or like a Wolfman Jack. Thinking about like Big Trouble in Little China, Jack Burton is always talking on his CB and doing his like little rants. Could definitely see something like that being integrated as well. But yeah, I think this one's pretty cool. Look at that. It's like, it's $13 for the PDF copy. I might take the plunge on that. I like it. Let's do another one. This one is a game called Meatheads. It is designed by Mark Conway. And I will just say right off the top, the reason I think this one might appeal to you, Tom, is because it kind of reminded me of the RPG you were working on, Going Commando, where Going Commando was sort of like a sexy G.I. Joe thing. Meatheads, it's kind of like bodybuilder Conan the Barbarian or bodybuilder He-Man, where it's an RPG with a sort of a Conan Masters of the Universe setting, but all the characters are fighters. You can only play fighters, and the meatheads are just, you know, there are different types of meatheads that you can play, but the whole idea is that they are just like bruisers and duelists, they say here. Don't trust wizards. Feel the curve of the blade with a 2d6 versus AC combat system following along the lines of chainmail, with certain weapons being more effective against armor than others, and your weapon's class factoring into parries and grapples. Tactics for when you need it, brute force for when you don't. And this is a very sort of tactics-heavy RPG. I took a look at the quick start guide that you can read, and it does sort of harken back to like original D&D, chainmail, that sort of system with rules, a lot of combat rules, rules for movement, how many squares a character can move, and you know, different values for different weapons and armors, different abilities for different classes. And then most of the thing is based around a gigantic 5-level mega dungeon crawl. So this is like a whole bunch of like hard body characters doing a big old dungeon crawl, armed to the teeth, bulging with muscles and weaponry. Let's go, pal. I'll prove I can make you an all-around beefcake fast, or it won't cost you a coin, says Mark Conway, the author of Meatheads. What do you think of this one, Tom? It's got some good art, too, I should say. Fun art.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess the thing is, if I were going to play this sort of game, this isn't where I'd start looking, you know? It's like I like this kind of throwback vibe to it. I don't particularly care about the whole beefcake vibe. I guess
it is pretty funny. You know, I almost feel like he should have leaned more, rather than it being like beefcake sort of bodybuilder, make it a lot more like pro wrestler. Like, give all your guys sort of wrestling-style gimmicks and personalities. It does mention, you know, fans of Conan the Barbarian, Masters of the Universe, bodybuilding and wrestling will feel right at home. But I almost feel like wrestling should sort of be closer to the top of inspirations there, just to give it more of an assortment of flavor, especially if you're all playing fighters.
Man, that makes me think of Rumbleverse. And if you could make... Man, if we could do some sort of like a Rumbleverse game with this. That'd be wild. I'd probably play
feels
that.
It feels like the system might be amenable to that. And yeah, it does have a real like classic D&D tactics kind of a feel to it that you can read about in the quick start guide. But I thought this was kind of fun. This is another one of those like Korgoth or Gru the Wanderer kind of inspired settings. Meatheads, I think, is a pretty good title for this kind of thing. Art looks fun. These days, I'm way less into like combat-oriented tactical RPGs, but I still appreciate what this one's bringing to the table.
It's funny, I feel like I said earlier in this episode that I'm like not really that into like comedy RPGs, right? Because I was talking about Paranoia, and yeah. I feel like all these games so far have had a certain element of like almost comedy RPG.
Well, Tom, then maybe this last one is the one that will tickle your fancy, because this one just popped up on my radar today, and I am already, like, again, this narrowing it down. This is currently in my top five if I was going to fund one of these, and it is a game called Home, which is mech and kaiju map making. Build a mech, map the unknown, fight kaiju, and save your home solo to four-player RPG. So Home, I'm just going to read, this is from Deep Dark Games, already surpassed its goal with a couple of weeks left on the crowdfunding campaign, and I'm just going to read the blurb from the designer here. Home is a role-playing and map-making game where you are a mech pilot who must protect their home from a kaiju invasion. Build your mech, map your world and the kaiju realm, prepare for battle, and clash against kaiju that will destroy your home if you fail. Important relationships keep you going in your darkest hour. Veteran pilots make sacrifices for the greater good, and you must decide whether to protect important infrastructure or cherish cities. Home is about action and exploration, but also about hope and loss. It says here, great one-shot experience, solo or up to four players, easy to learn with no prep or game master required. Reach your epic finale in 2 to 4 hours, maybe a little longer if you really like drawing and role-playing. A unique system that combines mech building, map making, and narrative-driven play. Easy to learn D6 dice pool that reflects your story arc. Draw maps of your world and the kaiju realm. No drawing skills necessary. Looks like the source book that's being funded provides lots of sort of basic map shapes, and then you add in your little iconography for things like your mech, your kaiju, the path you take. Create the world, pilots, and mechs you envision, and do your best to keep them alive. Choose from one of six playbooks, such as the prototype-loving engineer, the knightly royal, or the mysterious ethereal. Push deep into the kaiju realm to face increasingly dangerous kaiju, who are played by the other players. Use dozens of oracle tables to quickly build your mech, pilot, home, kaiju, and mission, which you'll need because things will die. And here I'll also read the blurb about the lore. 1 year ago, the rift opened and the kaiju attacked. It tore our cities apart, rampaging for days until we finally dropped the bomb. We killed the terrifying beast, but lost so much in the process. We knew more would come, so we built the mechs, giant war machines, the pinnacle of human engineering, and our only hope for survival. The rift is reopening. It won't be long before the kaiju emerge, but this time will be different. Your home depends on it. Are you ready, pilot? Very Pacific Rim. There's a great image right at the top of the campaign that says make this map, and it shows like a map being filled in. You can see the basic like topography detailing that comes with the game, and then you can also see like where the player has placed settlements. It looks like a few different features like a research institute, a radar station, Monument of the Lost. There's a big kaiju skeleton marked intruder. There's a railgun turret up on the mountaintop. Yeah, Home. What do you think of this? Now, I do know, though, that you're not huge on the big mecha thing, right? You've said that in the past.
Not huge on it, but I can enjoy it. And like, I don't know, I like this. I like the solo sort of like, I like the world building element. I really like the like what sort of entices me is some of the inspiration stuff. The fact that it has the quiet year in there is like, I that is another sort of like world building game that I quite enjoy. Although it also lists Starforge, which is something I've seen on Itch, and it says best tables ever, which makes me interested in Starforged.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, you're in a real tabletop table mood these days. So yeah, Starforged having best tables worth looking into.
Like that has playbooks. Yeah, it has lots of tables, it says. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that this was a very fun looking one. I really just like the map kind of interface to it. Reminds me a bit of never mind. I can't remember that. There was a computer game I played that had this kind of look to it, but I can't remember what it was called. But I really like the map building aspect to it. I like a giant robot. And I like fighting some kaiju, so it definitely seems like my jam. So Tom, we'll do the thing that I usually do at the end of these roundups, which is of these four, which speaks to you the most? We had 100% Modern Ghosts, we had Community Radio, Meatheads, and Home.
Probably home.
Yeah.
'Cause home like is it designed to be a solo game?
It can be solo or it can be multiplayer.
Yeah, I think definitely home is like out of these is the one this is the one that I would play.
For sure, yeah. Home and Community Radio is the other one of those four that really speaks to me. I think it's got some neat ideas in there. But of course, because it requires other players, that also means it'll take longer for me to get to it if I pick it up. Anyway, so there's four more Zine RPGs from Zine RPG Month. You can still find them on Kickstarter. The Zine Quest hashtag will help you see all of the Zine RPG crowdfunding campaigns that are going on right now. And I think this will be my last Zine RPG roundup for a little while since I've been doing them for the past few episodes. And it's probably time that I do a deep dive back into a system. Maybe I'll look at something like Paranoia even. But you better believe I'm gonna come back with more Zine RPGs in the future. Because I'm sure once February is out, we're gonna get a bunch of articles like on Dicebreaker that are saying the best Zine RPGs of Zine RPG Month, and then there'll be all sorts of other treats to look into.
So is that our episode?
I think so.
All right. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes or follow us, check us out on Facebook at Compare and Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. I've been your host, Tom Lando. I guess I can't say not me.
Don't steal because it's haunted.
Yeah, I mean,
Use the
don't
whole
steal because
meat.
it's haunted. Use the whole meat, all my things. Not me!
Pony up, get that zine.
Not me.